Welcome back to another episode of Let's Talk Security Testing, the podcast where we talk about all things security testing. Lost my words there. My name is Ben.
And I'm Tom.
And today we're going to talk about where do vulnerabilities come from? As a man with two young kids, I feel like that title is quite aptly named. Okay, where do we start? Tom, you want to kick us off with the first topic of this discussion?
Yeah, I think if I was to distill it down, I'd say that there's three primary sources of vulnerabilities. You know, there's
just hold on a sec. What do we mean by sources of vulnerabilities?
Places where vulnerabilities come from.
Okay.
The first is changes that you make, right? You have a system. That system is devoid of vulnerabilities. And then you tweak something. You add a functionality. You change a permission. You update a config here or there. And that introduces a vulnerability, right? That's the first one. The second is the addition of a new system, right? So it's not that you have tweaked a system, it's that you've got something new. You've acquired a company and you've inherited their assets, and their assets have vulnerabilities within them. Or you buy a new product or something along those lines, right? That introduces vulnerabilities. And then
third-party risk can come into that as well.
Third-party risk, yeah, that comes into that as well. You bring on a supplier, they're bringing with them all of the risks associated with their business. And then the third one is a change to the threat landscape. So this one is perhaps the least fair of all, this one is really about how you don't change anything inside your business at all, but a library that you use or a piece of software or an operating system, whatever it is, a researcher or a threat actor identifies a weakness and a deficiency within that system, discloses an exploit, and all of a sudden that system that was completely and totally secure a day ago is now completely and totally exposed a day later. To me, those are the three primary sources of vulnerabilities.
Okay. Makes sense. And how does that help us? How does understanding the sources of the vulnerabilities and thinking about them in this way rather than just lists that keep piling, how does that help?
Well, it gives us a place to look, right? It gives us something to tell us that a vulnerability might exist within a system, right? If you've got a system or your organization, for example, then if you can start to monitor for changes that are being made, changes to the threat landscape, and new assets being added, then those events as they occur, those various different changes are going to be the thing that instigate, or they should be the thing that instigate you looking for vulnerabilities, right? Every time a system gets updated, you should probably be thinking, has this introduced a new vulnerability? Every time a CVE gets disclosed or some public exploit comes out, you should probably be thinking, is this impacting my system? And if you are listening and if you're monitoring for those events, then in theory,
my brain's going more anecdotally, of course, given my role in this relationship. Mm-hmm. We're talking about sources and we're talking about overspill and overflow, and I've got this lake in my head, right, where the lake is overflowing, and the lake has three rivers that feed into it, three sources, right? But whereas within security teams, quite often we're looking at the lake and we're like, okay, how do we tackle this thing? But it would make way more sense, wouldn't it, to think about the sources of the lake, mm-hmm. And coming up with strategies as each source might be slightly different in the way that it brings water and the speed in which it brings water into the lake. You might have different strategies for how you approach each one. No? Are there noticeable differences in the way that you might approach finding vulnerabilities that come from a change versus finding vulnerabilities that might come from an ODAI or an asset?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you need to be monitoring them all, right? That's the first thing, and I don't think that should be different. Across the board, you need to find a way that you're able to detect when an event has occurred that indicates that any of those three sources is feeding potential for vulnerabilities into the system. But yeah, I mean, certainly the way that you actually go about validating whether those vulnerabilities have been introduced or not varies from source to source. If it is a change to an existing system, then you want to be doing a targeted test specifically tailored to that change, right? If you're adding a new form
before it hits production as well, crucially.
Ideally, if you've got the processes in place, doing it as soon as you possibly can. You close the feedback loop, you fix the vulnerability earlier and you're exposed for less time or ideally no time.
Which is a luxury that you're not afforded potentially with a new vulnerability in the wild.
It is, yes. But the advantage that you get with new vulnerabilities in the wild typically is it's a much more binary consideration, right? You have that piece of software and that vulnerability has been disclosed for that piece of software, which means you're much, much more likely to be exposed to that vulnerability. Not always, because there are going to be specific conditions under which that vulnerability is exploitable. But you can say with a much, much greater level of confidence that if, you know, I hate to use the same analogies that we always use, but if, you know, MOVEit or Log4j or something like that comes out and you know that you have that, these are the specific systems that you need to look for, these are the specific configurations, this is exactly what you should be looking for. And so, of course, you can tailor that stream in that way. You're still monitoring in the same way, but you're validating slightly differently. And then the addition of new systems, this is a much, much trickier one, right? This one, you're probably going to have to be a bit more flexible in terms of the way that you orchestrate your playbook, because identifying a new API endpoint is very, very different from identifying a new server, which is very different, again, from identifying a new workstation and from a SaaS platform. So I would always advocate for just having these defined playbooks for saying, this is when we identify this type of an asset having been introduced, this is the way that we test for that asset. And you can build and you can refine that playbook over time. You know, if you buy a new tool that's particularly good at testing APIs, of course that should be added into the playbook for when you detect a new API endpoint. But that's that third one, thankfully, you know. When something new is introduced, it's probably going to be the most laborious kind of test you do. You're going to need to baseline that specific entity. But generally speaking, is the thing that happens the least. The vulnerabilities coming out in the wild and in the threat landscape potentially is the thing that happens the most. You know, there's thousands and thousands of vulnerabilities disclosed every year, but hopefully only a very, very small number of edge cases actually need testing for, because the diversity of software that you actually use inside a business, even inside an enterprise business, isn't necessarily that big. And then the first one, the changes made to a system, those are the ones where I think it can be most challenging to understand exactly what you're supposed to be doing under a given situation. But as long as you've got the process in place, as long as you can do that, then you can be really, really strategic and really, really refined with the way you go about testing that and saying, okay, if it's this kind of a change, then we're going to just run automated tools because we know that they can find certain things. If it's this kind of a change, we're not going to test this at all because updating the copy to a website isn't going to introduce a vulnerability.
This is where I believe there starts to be strong similarities between offensive and defensive security. So historically, there is a clear separation, even just in the way that these functions operate, in that offensive security is very black box, very, random in its approach to performing security tests and sporadic. Mm-hmm. And defensive security tends to be a bit more military, very process-driven. It's picking up alerts and it's responding to those alerts to events. But what we're talking about here, talking about sources, talking about events, talking about, you know, the things that might be vulnerabilities that need investigated, this is very much like a defensive security conversation.
Yeah, you know, I think that defense has always had to be proactive, right? Mm-hmm. And offense has not quite had the same pressures in the way that we go about finding things, right? If you don't find a vulnerability for a month and you don't find that vulnerability for 6 months, A, it's not clear that you've not found that vulnerability unless it gets exploited, right? Which only happens in a very small number of cases, ideally, right? It's really hard to be able to prove that your offensive security testing has failed and that the process needs to have been improved. And also the impact of it's hard to measure. With defensive stuff, it's you know, fairly clear and fairly obvious, right? The if you're not being proactive, you are being exploited, and you can quite clearly attribute that back to a missing control or a failure of process.
Yeah, if I turned around and said to you, we have just discovered a vulnerability, it's been there for 6 months, but now we've fixed it. You are going to respond very differently to if I said to you, we've just discovered a threat actor on our network. He's been on there for 6 months, but don't worry, we've just fixed it. Yeah. a lot more questions on the second one than you are on the first one. I don't know why, because the first one could just as easily lead to bad, if not worse, consequences than the second one. But it the attitude is different, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the attitude is different. I think the reason why is because, you know, for most organisations, they've been fairly fortunate in that you are coming and you are saying we found a vulnerability, for most security teams, it's fairly fortunate in that they've got the scapegoat. You're coming and you're saying we found a vulnerability, but you're not saying it's been in the system for 6 months, right? You're just saying we found a vulnerability, and then everybody's happy that you found that vulnerability. Mm. If you're saying, and it's been in the system for 6 months, if you had that level of depth, people would probably be pretty unhappy. And also if you then said, and it's been exploited 9 times, then people would be even more unhappy. So I think that's why I don't want to say offensive security has been able to get away with it, because I don't think it's getting away with it. I just think it's hard.
Some of this new tooling on the market that's actually deployed at runtime and is detecting when vulnerabilities get exploited, particularly in software, is going to bring to light a lot of these things, because, you know, we are going to start to find ourselves in a world where those conversations do happen. And people can conclusively say that this vulnerability not only has existed for 6 months, but has actually been exploited 6 times in that period of time, you know? So the conversation's been dragged in this direction.
Yeah, you know, and I think to an extent we found ourselves on the, like in offensive security, we found ourselves on the back foot a little bit, or leaning a little bit too much on defense as the, you know, as the real catch-all, right? We say we have these catch-all methods for security testing where we've got scanners and we've got manual tests once a year and we do the best that we can do. But then we kind of say, if we don't find these vulnerabilities, defence should still be there and defence should still be identifying the vulnerabilities. But yeah, I think if you really held our feet to the fire and said, actually, no, this vulnerability shouldn't have been there because you should have caught it. Mm-hmm. You should have found mechanisms for preventing this from getting into production at all. Mm-hmm. Then we'd all be better off.
And again, right, just to bring this home, if I said to you, I'm sure people listening to this now are thinking, Tom, you're insane. Right, you know, you want me to use every single ticket as an event for testing. You want me to use every single potential vulnerability in the wild for security testing. Every single new asset for security testing. Like, we do a pen test every year and a monthly vulnerability scan. What are you talking about? But when we lean into defensive security and go, okay, yeah, these guys are responding to, you know, hundreds of alerts a day, thousands of alerts a day in some cases, for various different things and dealt with at different layers, you know, to what extent can we lean into some of the automated technology used to process these events initially, and the way that the humans then pick up and triage the relevant ones? How much of that can we learn from to implement this new style of testing?
That's a fair point, because look, this is being on the back foot or playing catch up to what defensive security has done has a massive advantage to us in that this is a solved problem. It's a problem that is not solved, or it's a solution that's not applied to offensive security. But yeah, processing large amounts of event data to identifying the suspicious events and then being able to orchestrate actions in order to resolve those events is something that defensive security does every single day. It's not even just something defensive security does. You know, it's things that air traffic controllers have been doing for decades, right? Thousands of flights all need to be orchestrated in the same place, and if a flight's going off course, whatever else, then that all needs to be corrected. In the last few years, technology has made it much, much easier for defensive security, or much more effective for defensive security, to be efficient about doing this. And these days, speaking as somebody who tries to break into systems, I can say with a great level of confidence that while there are still ways to be able to do it, defensive security has just matured massively, leaps and bounds, because of things like large language models, which can pass unfathomable amounts of information and identify anomalous outliers to the norm. So yeah, all we really need to do is look at how SIEMs and how SOARs and how MDR work and say, you know, how does that apply to security testing? How do they ingest events? How do they process the events? How do they flag the key things that need to be done? And then how do they do things like execute playbooks? Playbook is a term that is known, like, fundamentally, it's a core concept inside defensive security, and it doesn't even exist as a word inside offensive security, or didn't until a year or two ago, and we're now starting to see it, and we're now starting to recognize the value of looking at what the market has already done and applying that to our own discipline.
And great news, we've just helped businesses find a shed load more vulnerabilities they didn't know about.
Well,
fantastic. But how does event-based or change-based security testing actually help beyond that? How does it help them either fix, remediate, understand more further down the channel?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was gonna challenge you on that, because I don't necessarily agree that we've helped them find a shed load more vulnerabilities, right? It's not about finding more vulnerabilities. With like your annual pen test, as long as it's a half decent pen test and they've been provided with the right information, we'll probably find the same vulnerabilities. It's about finding the vulnerabilities sooner, and about being able to say confidently at any point throughout the year that you know what vulnerabilities are present within that system. Not what vulnerabilities were present 7 months ago when you did your last pen test, but what vulnerabilities are present on that day. And then finding them sooner doesn't just mean that you know which vulnerabilities are present that day, but it also means that it's much, much more cost effective to be able to fix them, right? If you can get them straight back into that development team who are deeply familiar with that area of the code, might even have that pull request open and it's not actually been committed into production yet, then not only does that reduce the exposure, the amount of time that somebody has to be able to exploit it, but it also just means that developer will thank you because it's an easier job to be able to resolve that issue.
But then, yeah, okay. So not necessarily finding a shed load of more vulnerabilities, but we help them to find it sooner. Are there still any net positives that occur further down the channel when it comes to things like remediation, understanding, analysis of the vulnerabilities themselves?
Yeah, I mean, the you know, shift left is becoming a bit of a dirty word in security, but having that attribution right back to the very, very source of a vulnerability, and you know, this goes back to what we were talking about before, sources, right? Being able to say exactly why something got added into a system, a vulnerability, I mean, got added into a system, means that you can actually start to do root cause analysis, and you can start to treat things at their source, right? Rather than just dealing with the symptoms, you're dealing with the causes. You're saying, okay, SQL injection has been introduced into this system. I know that it was introduced because this process failure. I knew it was introduced because this person needs a little bit of additional training, or not even necessarily a bit of training, right? They just, like, I know that because the pen tester found this, the developer had just developed it, and the two of them sat down together once that vulnerability was found and could talk through it, and it mattered to the developer because they still felt some ownership for the area of code that they'd been touching, and it mattered to the pen tester because it was an active live vulnerability, then that much, much shorter feedback loop helped to actually treat things at their source.
I would say that it's not even a shift left thing, right? And this information is available in some of the tools for specific cases, but massive potential for CISOs, heads of InfoSec that are listening today, to understand some of the strategic bottlenecks that are causing their vulnerability challenges, right? Mm-hmm. Is it Dave the dev? Is it the use of that library? Is it this particular supplier? Or is it, you know, the way in which we spin up new API endpoints or the way in which we increase the size of our AWS estate? You know, these are the sorts of answers. If you could sort of look at your vulnerability pool and say, you know, where are they coming from, or where are the really challenging ones come from, or where are the ones that are above our risk tolerance coming from? Mm-hmm. And fixing some of those problems, you know, going back to the stream analogy I said earlier, you know, if your lake's overflowing, maybe you need to build a dam on stream one, because stream one is the one that's bloody flooding the place. Maybe stream two and stream three are manageable.
Yeah,
but, these are some of the things that I think when we're looking at a big pool of vulnerabilities and just treating them as a unit, we're not going to get there.
Yeah, or not even building a dam over source one, right? It's about saying, what is it that's actually feeding that stream to begin
sure.
with? Like, you know, because to be clear,
I think this is a podcast on waterways at this point.
Right? Yeah. Analogy aside, you know, it's not that I say that changes to a system are a primary source of vulnerability, but obviously it's not all changes to a system. There are very, very specific changes that will introduce a vulnerability. Those will vary from organization to organization, development team to development team, but being able to actually drill right down into the minutiae of saying, okay, it's these specific kinds of changes under these specific circumstances that are the ones that introduce vulnerabilities, mean that you can genuinely introduce the controls that are targeting those and actually genuinely start to prevent those vulnerabilities from ever occurring again.
Fantastic. So as I meander through to the end of the episode, I'll give you my summary, and I guess you can bolt onto that if you want. Three types of three sources of vulnerabilities. I think everyone just needs to understand this, right? Three sources. Vulnerabilities do not appear by magic. They appear because you change something inside the business, you grow or shrink the business in some way, or they change from outside the business, right? Everything goes in one of those three buckets. And if you can get them in them buckets, has a knock-on impact in the way that you process, manage, fix everything with the vulnerabilities themselves. Look at defensive security. Every business is doing this now from a security operations center perspective. You're using humans to process, you're using humans to research specific events where appropriate, and you're using tools like EDR to take a lot of that heavy lifting away from the humans and automate some of the decision-making around what is and isn't a threat. Reverse the language, use tools to determine what is and isn't potentially a vulnerability, and then use humans to come in to pick up where the tools clearly have limitations. Anything to add to that summary?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the only thing I would say on top of that is we've, as an industry, not been that scientific over the years, and we've not been that reflective about how we can actually improve our processes. We've said, you know, security testing is hard, finding vulnerabilities is hard, but it kind of works. Let's just keep doing more of it. Let's scan more frequently. Let's pen test more frequently. But I think
I hope you're not about to say that hacking is more of a science than an art.
I think if hacking was more of a science than an art, then we might find that the actual outcomes of that would be more effective, would be more efficient, and actually would work more cohesively with the rest of the business, which is what we're really trying to shoot for here.
Well, you heard it here first from a pen tester, nonetheless. Thanks for listening this week. That's just about the end of the podcast. You can get us on YouTube, you can get us on Spotify, Apple. We're all over the place at the moment. This is great. Yeah, I'll catch you in a couple of weeks. I'm excited. This is great.
Cool. Bye now.